Good morning. It's Monday, April 15th. The war in the Middle East is now 192 days old. I'm Enya Kravine, Senior Director of the Israel Program and National Security Network at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, standing in for John Schanzer on today's FGD Morning Brief. I'm reporting to you this morning from Israel, where the country is experiencing a tense but quiet Monday after Iran launched a direct attack on the Jewish state this weekend. While Iran has been attacking Israel through its proxies for years, this is the first time that Iran has directly attacked Israel from Iranian soil. The attack involved a reported 170 explosive-laden drones, 30 cruise missiles, and 110 ballistic missiles, targeting the Jewish state with approximately 60 tons of explosive materials. We'll dive into more on that on today's show. We'll also hear from our guest this morning, Amit Segal. I've been following Amit's work for years. He's a highly respected journalist and commentator and has a reputation for getting the scoops in the Knesset. We will speak with Amit in just a few short minutes about how the government is coping in the robust threat environment, live right here on the FGD Morning Brief. But before we get to Amit, there's a lot to be said about Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel. Let's start with some background. This weekend's Iranian attack was said to be in response to an April 1st strike on Damascus that killed several IRGC members, including the head of the IRGC's elite Quds force in Syria and Lebanon. The Quds forces are the guys that work outside of Iran's borders and responsible for funding, training, and arming Iran's terror proxies. The guy who was killed was the top coordinator between Tehran and Hezbollah. The Biden administration quickly denied involvement in the strike on Damascus and implicated Israel, claiming that Israel did not notify Washington in advance. Iran quickly vowed to retaliate against the Jewish state. But Iran certainly wasn't planning a surprise attack. Quite the opposite. Iran broadcasted its intent to attack for over a week, giving Israel and its allies plenty of time to prepare its defense. As early as April 6, there were U.S. administration leaks that Iran would target Israeli military sites and not civilian targets. Just hours after the attack on April 14th, Iran's foreign minister said in a press conference that Tehran noticed DC before launching the strike. There was clearly a lot of back channeling going on before the attack. Partly thanks to advance warning, Israel, the US, Jordan, France, the Brits, and other partners in the region were able to thwart 99% of Iran's more than 300 missiles and drones. Iran's proxies didn't want to miss out on the fun either, so they piled on, sending additional rockets and missiles from Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. The good news, the U.S.-led regional security architecture works. The bad news, D.C. does not seem interested in holding the mullahs in Iran accountable. President Biden has said he is working to coordinate a united diplomatic response to the Iranian attack, which I doubt has anybody shaken in their boots. So the question is out there, will there be consequences for the Islamic Republic of Iran? It certainly doesn't seem like there are any serious consequences coming out of Washington. From Israel's perspective, a response against the regime in Tehran could have major implications for the entire region. But no response could also have consequences, including the normalization of these types of attacks, which, if not for the advance notice from Iran and Israel's impressive layered missile defense system, could have been catastrophic for the Jewish state. Folks, Iran attacked Israel with over 100 ballistic missiles that were each as big as a Greyhound bus. One small miscalculation could have led to a disaster. I don't know about you, but I don't like the idea of the Ayatollah playing Russian roulette with Israeli lives. But if that wasn't big enough news for one weekend, there was much, much more going on in the region in the past 36 hours, which brings me to our headlines. Headline one. On Saturday, Iran's Revolutionary Guard seized an Israeli-linked vessel near the Strait of Hormuz. Footage allegedly taken from the incident shows a helicopter hovering over a container ship and commandos rappelling onto the deck of the ship. This is just the most recent of more than a dozen incidents whereby Iran has seized military or commercial ships in a larger pattern of Iran's maritime aggression. My colleagues, Bradley Bowman and Ryan Probst, have a great tracker up on FDD's website if you'd like to learn more. Headline two, later on Sunday, the Israeli security forces recovered the body of a 14-year-old boy who had gone missing while shepherding in the West Bank the previous day. The boy was allegedly killed by Palestinian terrorists. The kidnapping and murder led to a further unrest in the West Bank as Israelis and Palestinians clashed, resulting in several injuries and the death of a Palestinian man. The West Bank remains a volatile front for Israel, and we'll be following these incidents of unrest closely. And headline three, also over the weekend, Hezbollah rockets continued to rain down on northern Israel, and an explosive-laden drone critically injured one man. The IDF continued operations against Hezbollah and Hamas, striking targets in both Lebanon and Gaza. All that to say that while Israel was facing the largest drone, cruise, and ballistic missile barrage in its history, it was also militarily engaged with threats on at least three other arenas. Iran's ring of fire strategy was firing on all fronts. It was a busy weekend. I'm now pleased to introduce Amit Segal. Amit is the chief political correspondent and commentator for Channel 12 News, Israel's most popular and influential news outlet, and for Yediot Ahronot, the country's best-selling newspaper. His newspaper, his book, The Story of Israeli Politics, was Israel's bestseller in 2021. Welcome, Amit. I understand you're joining us from Israel's Knesset today.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being here. Please start by setting the scene for us. What's the mood in the Knesset this week?
Well, the Knesset is actually on its annual spring recess, so there is no one at the Knesset, but things happen in Israel in the cabinet, which is quite close to us. And there is a mixed feeling of, from one hand, the recovery from the failure of October 7th. Israel has demonstrated powerful military abilities when it comes to handling the Iranian attack. And on the other hand, there is still no decisive victory to write home about, because no one, even in American football or in Israeli soccer, can win a game only by defense. You have to score.
Okay. You mentioned the Israeli cabinet. The Israeli war cabinet reportedly met yesterday afternoon, to decide on Israel's response to the Iranian attack. What are you hearing from that meeting, or indeed meetings that have happened since then?
Well, I mean, there are two options, or maybe even three. One is not to respond. We have a president from 1991, the first Gulf War, where Israel actually experienced a missile attack from Iraq, from Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And Shamir, the then Israeli prime minister, wanted to respond decisively, but the then president, George Bush, asked him not to do so. Exactly like Biden asked Netanyahu. Two differences. One, the attack was way more severe yesterday. Plus then, Bush asked Shamir not to respond because he had initiated a war against Iraq in a U.S.-led coalition. Now, Biden does not ask Israel to stay aside while he's attacking Iran, but he asks Israel not to respond at all. That's the dilemma. So I don't think that staying silent is an option, but there is a level to which Israel can adjust itself. For instance, would your response against Iran, according to what really happened on the ground, which is barely nothing, there is one injured Israeli, or to respond according to what the Iranians had planned in the first place, which is to actually destroy at least two major military bases, which is, give or take, a war. So I guess the response will be somewhere in between.
Okay. Staying on the war cabinet for a moment, the war cabinet has been under some stress in recent months. Can you remind listeners about the composition of the war cabinet, how and when it was formed, and tell us how you think it's holding up?
Israel's war cabinet is, like Lincoln said, a cabinet of foes. Netanyahu actually built his own cabinet a year ago based on his right-wing government. Now, on the fourth day of the war, Gantz and Eisenkot from the opposition joined forces with the government, and they actually got a seat around the table. which means that statistically Netanyahu has a majority, but it's not about a vote counting, it's about weight around the table. And it says that Netanyahu is no longer the sole owner of the situation. I would say that Netanyahu is way for more military actions, not signing an unbearable hostage deal with Hamas, whereas I think Gantz and Eisenkot think that hostages should be put on the first place. And the same applies for the response to Iran. Gantz and Eisenkot lead a bit more dovish response, while Netanyahu is more for the hawkish side of the table.
Okay, and have there been any threats recently for any of the members of the war cabinet to leave? And what would that mean for the Israeli, for the cabinet and for the Israeli war effort?
In my opinion, it's going to be a disaster for the Israeli war efforts, because the way to effectively fight Hamas and Iran's proxies is by showing and signaling a unity within Israel, which was considered quite divided. There are opinions that this division led to the war because Israel's enemies saw it as a weakness. Therefore, in my opinion, once Gantz and Eisenkot leave the table, it means necessarily that every step taken by this war cabinet will be considered as political, as a hawkish pro-Likud step, and not, as it seems today, as a professional thing.
Okay. So, Amit, as well as commenting on Israeli politics, you've also been known to weigh in on U.S. politics. Are U.S. politics affecting Israel's policymaking?
I think that's the general view in Israel, that Henry Kissinger once said that Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, only a domestic one. Many Israelis feel the same about the U.S. heading in a tenth election, maybe the most dramatic election over the last decades. And they fear that electoral considerations actually lead the U.S. administration towards a more harsh policy towards Israel, due to all those, Muslim voters in Michigan and in Nevada, etc. To be honest, I think that Israel's luck is that it happened on an election year. Maybe in a year after the election, every second term U.S. president would not be very pro-Israeli, because, we have a history with second term presidents. Usually they were more, or I wouldn't say more hostile towards Israel, but less cooperative.
Interesting. Okay, last question. Israelis are known to vote on security issues. What's your read on how Israelis are feeling today?
Well, security is Israel's number one issue. That's why we found within the Israeli right wing a socialist party, and the so-called center-left in Israel is led by the most capitalist party leaders. It's quite a peculiar situation. In my opinion, October 7th actually took Israelis from something that had begun to develop, which is a more domestic issues-oriented politics. You probably saw all these fights about the legal reform and the ultra-Orthodox relationship with the Israeli society. I think it's turning back now to security, which allegedly means that the right wing should prevail, because Israel's right wing getting stronger and stronger over the time, both demographically and opinion-wise. But what makes it very interesting and unpredictable is the fact that this failure happened under a far right-wing government, which means that whereas people find the right-wing's policy more attractive, they find the right-wing leadership less attractive. So there is something interesting here between people want hawkishness and they want change. So whoever is gonna vote, gonna offer them with those two ingredients, gonna hit the jackpot.
Fascinating. And maybe just one more, since it looks like we have a little bit of time. How are Israelis feeling today after this massive attack from Iran? And you mentioned that the October 7th was such a huge Israeli security failure, and now the world is seeing Israel respond to this massive attack with a 99% success. Is that how are Israelis feeling? Is there a shift in your opinion?
I think Israel is sadder place than it used to be, but it's slowly recovering. We still have the hostage situation in Gaza. Everyone knows a friend or a friend's friend who is in Gaza or got injured or killed. And it makes Israel a sadder place. But the more successes we have in Gaza, the more we see the Israeli army operating, the more as time passes, I think Israelis are, in my opinion at least, coming back to their senses, to their old-fashioned optimism.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you so much, Amit Segal, for joining us today on the FDD Morning Brief.
Thank you, and happy Passover.
Thank you. Here's what FDD has on tap for you today. My colleagues Sinan Jidi and Melissa Sachs are out with a new piece about the relentless enabling of Hamas by Turkish officials. Since October 7th, Turkey's safe harboring of Hamas has actively gone against the efforts of other NATO allies, including the US, to thwart Hamas activity. Sinan and Melissa analyze Turkish leadership connections and identify individuals enabling Hamas. These connections aren't surprising, but what is shocking is how openly Turkish leaders flaunt their terror ties. FDD's Eyal Hulata and Natalie Econow published on the role of pragmatic Arab countries in charting a new path for the region. My colleagues pull apart a new, thoughtful, and comprehensive document put out by members of the GCC, leading champions of the Palestinian cause, that make clear that Israel's existence is not up for negotiation. And finally, my colleague Ivana Stradner, who has co-authored a piece in the Kiev Post that dives into the propaganda crusade Russia recently launched after the ISIS-K attack on a Moscow concert hall by erroneously blaming Ukraine for the attack. Ivana breaks down why Putin's go-to move is to spread disinformation and why the West would be smart to fight him head-on with what Putin fears most, truth and transparency. That's it for today, people. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org, read our quick takes on X at FDD, and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another episode of the FDD Morning Brief. I'll be filling in for John again, and I'll chat with special guest Israeli journalist Laser Berman. Laser brilliantly covers the Israeli national security beat for the Times of Israel, so I'm sure he'll have lots of news to share. I'm Enya Kravine, signing off for FDD. Thank you.